Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
There are in India a group of persons who call themselves Baals, B-A-U-L, and they are known as the Sufis of India. They're rather like Sufis. They're kind of a freewheeling spirit thing that people would like to be. If they follow any kind of a discipline, they follow the Samkhya Yoga, which is a very, very old yoga system. Yoga meaning, in this case, not exercises, as Hatha Yoga is exercises of the body, but Samkhya Yoga then is would be the exercises of the spirit, because it points to the spiritual enlightenment to do their disciplines, their exercises. And a great deal of the religions in India are based on Samkhya Yoga. And of course there is some of it in Zen, because Buddha did study Samkhya Yoga. Kapila, when he devised this, it was way back when, out of the Vedas he did it. He got all this together. And there are some people that say that Kapila was the smartest man that ever lived. And there are other people that say, no, it was Nagarjuna. So it all depends on what school you adhere to. Anyway, they do a poetry thing for their, if somebody's going to talk, they usually start with a little kind of a poem. And of course, translated, they no longer rhyme. If they ever did in the beginning anyway, but anyway. This one starts out now with, "Come if you wish to meet the novel man. He has abandoned his worldly possessions for the beggar's sack that hangs on his shoulder. He speaks of the eternal mother, and in this instance they call her Kali, K-A-L-I, the Eternal Mother, even as he enters the Ganges. Simple words can overcome ignorance and disbelief. Kali and Krishna are one. The words may differ. The meaning is precisely the same. He who has broken the barrier of words has conquered limits. Allah or Jesus, Moses or Kali, the rich or the poor, the sage or the fool, all are one and the same to him. Lost in his own thoughts, he seems insane to others. He opens his arms to welcome the world, calling all to the ferry boat that is tied to the coast of life." So, come if you wish to meet the novel man. Now, the search of the Baals, is this search for this novel man, which Christianity would call the new man. St. Paul calls him the new man, which he says to put off concerning the former manner of life, the old man, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that ye put on the new man, which after God is created in true holiness. So now, what or who is this true man? That certainly isn't a thought. It's a new man. Yeah. And we search. And of course, here we say we search for enlightenment. Now, what is it that is going to be enlightened? We can search and we can strive, and we do, we search for something. Searching, we search for either being or we search for having. You know, it's rather, in a way, kind of like a choice between having yourself or having worldly possessions. Possessing many, many things, many, many things. Finally, we find that we are possessed by them. It's the same, in a way, you know, have many thoughts, many thoughts, many thoughts. And finally, you finally realize you're possessed by your thoughts. Your thoughts own you. You don't own your thoughts. Your beliefs. Do they own you? Or can you set them aside to be a little more open? Now, a worldly man, what we would call a worldly man, one who thinks in terms of having. He's going to have some money, he's going to have lots of property, he's going to have lots of power, thinking that the more he has, the more he can accumulate, the more he is, you know? He's bigger. So that his security then is in things. But you can have all these things. And be very empty. Without a search for yourself. With a search for yourself, you can have all these things, but there is a self there. You know, it's not really so much a matter of what we're accumulating. You know, it is the accumulation, the attitude that we have toward accumulation. You can accumulate cracker box tops and get lost in them. Some people have match covers, napkins from all over the world, coasters, ashtrays. You know, they're accumulating and they get lost in it. So, you know, a person that accumulates, evidently he feels very good when his hands are full. They're full of things, and he feels that he's achieving something. You know, he feels that he's successful. His hands are full. He's got a trunk full of box tops. He's achieved this, you know. This is what the Baals call, and St. Paul calls, the old man. This is what we have done. We have accumulated our beliefs and our prejudices and our thoughts, and we have accumulated a lot of things. See? And it is, the old man is our everyday behavior. To spend all of our energy on box tops is really kind of silly, isn't it? While we do not know what or who we are. And we forget, you know, that we are the two-faced Janus. We can look in two directions, you know. So we look the other way. And when you do look the other way, you change the direction of the search. You know. And then this is what the Baals call noble. So one begins to think in terms of being. In terms of an inner solidity. In terms of the inner consciousness. Of a certain kind of a rootedness that comes about. There is a certain centering out of which we begin to function. And there begins to be little insights as to, maybe that's what I am. And so through this, there comes a certain security in oneself, rather than in other things. And other things also include other people's opinions. A security in oneself. Now, of course, this switchover takes a little time, and it takes a little practice, and it takes some discipline. And so finally, though, we do wind up focused on being, on a beingness, but at the same time remembering we are in this world and that it is necessary that we follow Caesar to some extent, because we do need to eat and we need shelter and we need clothes. We aren't streakers. I could have told it in there, couldn't I? We do not abandon daily life. It is part of the search. It is part of the search of being, our daily life. But these two ways, these two searches in a way, coexist. But first comes being. First comes being. And there is in the folklore of India an old story of a nun, and a king fell in love with her when he saw her with her group there. And he wanted her for his queen. And finally the nun accepted. She would become his queen on a condition that she be given an isolated room in this palace, which belonged to her alone. Only she had the key, and only she was allowed in. So she used to go there every day. And it seemed to the king that as he lived with her, that she became more and more beautiful. There was a radiance about her that he saw about no one else. And it actually, in a way, began to disturb him. He got a little bit jealous because he wanted to be that way also. So he finally decided that he would find out what she did in this room, because obviously this is where whatever it was happened. In this room, she had some kind of a miracle going on in there, or some kind of creams or some kind of something. So he followed her. And he sort of hid behind one of the, there were drapes on the wall. But other than that, the room was quite bare. It was painted white. Nothing in the room except there was a hanger, and she had some old clothes hanging on it, kind of like a sackcloth, and she changed her clothes. Her beautiful clothes for this old piece of clothing. And then she sat down. And she sat there quite a while. And finally she turned around and she said to him, because she knew he was there, and she says, "Here, I am myself." Mm-hmm. I'm a woman who loves God, who loved God before ever she became a queen. I'm a woman who still loves God. And I love him in his divine way. The divine play, you do understand that. You know, we had that here a few lessons back. That all of this is the play of God. So this is the divine play in which we are involved. So here's this woman, this very devoted and evidently somewhat enlightened woman who could become a queen. Even though she was a nun, and even though she was a queen, she still sat and meditated and enjoyed the divine play. Now, the Samkhya Yoga makes a declaration. It says that everything can be explained. Everything. Everything can be explained. Everything that exists. Everything that we see and hear and touch and taste and smell. Everything that makes an appearance for us. It makes an appearance because of our senses. Our eyes don't see true and our hearing doesn't hear right and so on and so on. So everything is an appearance. It's a phenomenal appearance. Phenomenal reality. And they say that nothing exists that we cannot know by deduction. And the deductive system, of course, then is the Samkhya. The process of deduction is a descent into Prakriti, which is the great nature. It is a downward movement into this nature, and it is, by modern psychologists today, it is called the unconscious. It is a downward movement to the nadir, the bottom of everything. And the moment that you hit the bottom, it goes back and straight up. Creating then, of course, this vertical line, so to speak. Upward swing, the moving down into the depths and then up. Now, it is true, I think, though, that some people are afraid of going down to the bottom because they don't know what's going to be there. Well, what is there, of course, is nothing at all to be frightened of. At all. This is the great nature. This is the mother. Nothing to be frightened of. So the Samkhya disciple makes this very conscious effort. He really strives, you know, to understand what there is. That means he has to get rid of his fears. What there is, that means he has to get rid of his guilt. What there is, what there is, you know? And he refers to himself as a scientist. A scientist, you know, uses his apparatus in the laboratory, you know, the retorts and the to do his thing. And so the disciple in Samkhya Yoga, in trying to understand, and he calling himself a scientist, he uses his apparatus. The apparatus he has to use is himself. It's all we've got. However you use yourself, this is what you've got. in order to discover and understand, this is what you've got to use. And so Samkhya says that this is a scientific method. You're like a scientist, using what you've got. See, I'm telling you what they say. Now this disciple, in his conscious effort to understand, makes use of everything that he has already discovered. That means everything that he has experienced. Because everything that you have experienced has been some kind of a discovery. You discovered that you have feelings. You have discovered that you feel things. You have discovered that you have sensations. You make use of all of these. Or did you not realize that you have discovered all these things? You're just automatically there with them? So that now this disciple, the material we say that he has to use is the events of his life. And he uses these events now. He uses these events. He looks at them to show him the relationship between the known and the unknown. It's a very precise method. He's not necessarily a prayerful person, and because he doesn't petition any God. He says it's not necessary. He just has an attitude of openness. He questions and he observes. Now, and he observes very minutely. And this is all within this structure of the Samkhya. He searches within himself for familiar sensations. That's a familiar sensation. How closely have you ever looked at it? He searches that familiar sensation so intently that eventually he comes face to face with a law that is unfolding. Such a little thing, can bring about such a result. You know, every time that you move, there is some law involved. We could call them cosmic laws. To understand these great, great, great laws, the working of them, you have to search yourself. You can't search the sky. We are involved with laws of great power, of which we know next to nothing, to which we even give no thought. There is a koan in Zen. It goes, when I sneeze, the lion in Africa is affected. Why? There is some kind of law involved there that whatever I do here affects a lion in Africa. Whatever you do here affects something, somebody else. and we give this no thought. And yet we move in them. We live with them. Laws we have never seen. How many here have seen gravity? Have you seen it? They tell you it's there, and you believe it, because you can watch the tides. Yeah. Now, this disciple in Samkhya, he knows that through overcoming obstacles within himself, this inner man will attain a greater level of consciousness. In other words, what they call today the expansion of consciousness comes about through the overcoming of obstacles. Because after all, what we, the search of being, is about is the evolution of consciousness. Just to go through a messy mire, a knothole, an obstacle, you know, and to come out on the other side and breathe a sigh of relief, you know, that I got through that and go racing on from there, you know, it doesn't do much good. So the Samkhya student is involved in the detail. There is a tremendous attentive vigilance over what is going on. The immense work he puts into this gathering of detail upon detail upon detail until he breaks through into the law that's working. Yeah. The picture becomes very clear then. And they say, these Baals say, that to live such a life is to live a prayer. Now, in the Zen approach, we are not given many details as a general rule. We're given a koan. And through that, through the observation of that, something occurs in the psyche as the seed is sown. One should be attentive, and one should have the attentiveness of the Bao, of the Samkhya, you know, because it's... It's pay attention. And that's what it means. Pay attention. You're observing yourself and a problem. No. When you have experienced, you know, these obstacles in your psyche, and when you have realized a sufficient number of problems that are koan, then there's a picture that begins to stand out. And by picture, I mean what there is, what actually is. And for me, it was a very marvelous, simple way of going up the mountain. I mean, Samkhya is a Zen is in the Samkhya, all these details are to be coped with. And in Zen, because there, it doesn't involve itself in all these details that can be talked about, why there is no philosophy as such. So, and some people even say it's not even a religion, you know, although they do hold, you know, to this everlasting light. And they are after the pearl that is in the mouth of the dragon. Yeah. Now, in following the detail of the Samkhya, we begin at the top. We don't begin at the bottom, we begin at the top. And at the top we have Purusha and Prakriti. These are the two ultimate realities in Samkhya, because it is a dualistic system. They came along later and realized this wasn't so good, and they've added Mahaprakrit, Mahapurusha, and then they put something on top of that yet. But basically, it's Purusha and Prakrit. Purusha is the true self. It is the spirit. The true self is not the empirical ego. And Prakrit is the primordial nature. Purusha is the prime mover of Prakrit. We think of nature as being very active. You know, the flowers bloom, and the animals run, and the birds fly. All this activity comes about by a mover which itself does not move. And they use an example, and some of you are very familiar with this example. Purusha is the mover, the prime mover. He doesn't move. He's like a magnet. Prakrit is the iron filings all over here. And the patterns come about because of the magnet. The patterns, the iron filings. You can try that at home. You'll see these different patterns that arise. It's interesting. So. And then also, they liken it to Purusha in its relation to Prakrit. Is compared to a lame man seated on the shoulder of a blind man who walks. The lame man serves as the guiding eye, while the actual walking is done by the blind man. Interesting, huh? Picture that they created. Now, very often in this Samkhya system, they say as above, so below. Which simply means that what happens in this phenomenal world also happens in the noumenal world, or on our way to in this search for the noumenal world. Here in this phenomenal world, the child must come to know its mother before it can know its father. When it comes to know its mother and gets along a little ways in this, then it begins to rebel in order to break the family tie, which it must so it can stand on its own feet. This is all normal. It wants to be free. It wants to be free. Now, here we are, and we're searching for this Purusha. Purusha must come out from amongst them and be therefore separate, you know. So Prakrit, Purusha, must come to know Prakrit, the mother, in order to be free of her. Yeah. When Purusha has extricated himself from Prakrit, he stands quite alone and is knowable as Purusha. Now, this is Samkhya. This whole vast universe this multifaceted, heterogeneous universe is the unfolding of the patterns of a homogeneous Prakriti, one substance, one pattern into all this manyness, this multiplicity. And the patterns are all caused by this prime mover in his state. And it gives the appearance of a multiplicity of Prakriti. But homogeneous she is, and to this homogeneousness she will return. If there is no mover, then what? They have a, I guess you'd call it a metaphor that they use, that Prakriti is Purusha's wife. They're together. And she is shrewd, and she is peevish. She nags. And she gives him, Purusha, no rest. He has no respite until he has become so harassed by her that he finally says, I'm going away. You do what you like. And Prakriti immediately has a change of face. Immediately. She begins to run after him. And she's in tears, and she implores him, and she clings to him. And as the saying goes, you know, as soon as you become detached from Prakriti, everything follows you. This is not attachment, huh? See. And there is an old poem. And it, again, it doesn't come out as a poem when it's translated. But if you turn your back to the sun, your shadow is in front of you. You can try to catch it, but you will never succeed. But the minute that you turn to face the sun, your shadow is behind you. If you move, it follows you. You can make it go where you wish. So now the sun is the truth, and the shadow is Prakriti. Now this prime mover, this Purusha, this true self, this Jivatman, is outside of time. And it is quite beyond our mental grasp. And it is also beyond our mental understanding. It is outside time. Prakriti exists in time. She is an aggregate of qualities. They call them gunas, qualities, gunas. So that we have, you know, in the thing, Saguna Brahm, the God with qualities, and the Nirguna Brahm, the God without qualities. See, which in we have also in Christianity. We have God, that is a personal God, and then we have the Godhead, about which no one knows anything because it has no qualities. Now, it is in Prakrit, it is actually the qualities that we evaluate. Purusha is like a flash of perception. It's a flash of insight. And Prakrit operates in a very mechanistic style. This is why Gurdjieff always said, you know, stop being so mechanical. And the relationship with Prakrit, which moves mechanically and always in circles, and the Purusha outside of time, now not outside of Prakrit, but outside of time, he is immersed in this Prakrit as the prime mover, outside of time. You know where it says in the prologue of St. John, and the darkness encompasseth him not.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.